You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, 25 years ago, Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as president of the Soviet Union. This act marked the end of the communist government in Russia and other newly formed or reformed countries. Still has echoes in today's global politics. We'll hear about that coming up. First, Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel sat down with us last week to take a look back at 2016 and to talk about his priorities for 2017. It was an eventful year with some ongoing challenges like opioid abuse and new issues like a backlog of untested rape kits and decisions on how to proceed after court rulings on the John Doe investigation. Attorney General Schimmel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start, a lot we want to get through, but let's start with the opioid addiction problem here in Wisconsin. This has been a big issue for you, for legislators, for public health officials around the state. What's the latest in your efforts to turn the tide?
Well, we've seen some encouraging results from our public awareness campaign. We launched the Dose of Reality campaign back in September of 2015, and since then we really had two drug take-back days where that campaign's been in effect, and we've seen dramatic increases in the amount of medications that are being turned in by citizens. In our April drug take-back day, we collected over 64,000 pounds.
Wow. I thought you were going to say pills, pounds.
Pounds. That made us number three in the nation. Only Texas and California collected more, and California only collected 200 pounds more than Wisconsin. Then fast forward to October, when we did the next drug take-back day, we were number two in the nation. Only Texas beat us out, and they beat us by 600 pounds. What that tells me is that this is taking hold. Our message to people is that you need to use prescriptions as prescribed to you. Store them safely and securely, and when you're done, dispose of them properly. We know that 70% of the time when people start abusing prescription painkillers, they didn't get them from a doctor, they didn't get them from a traditional drug dealer, they got them from a family member or a friend who shared or you stole them. So if we can get that under control, we can start attacking this problem. And I think seeing those kind of drug take-back results is huge news. We've collected over 207,000 pounds in the last 2 years.
And you've told us before, I think, just because it's not drug take-back day today, that doesn't mean right. You can't dispose of your medications. There are options
right.
year-round.
And actually, most of what's being brought together on those 2 days every year is coming from evidence rooms at the police departments where people turn it in every day. You're absolutely right on that. And there's one other aspect, too, that's got some encouraging news. Our Dose of Reality was also aimed at the medical community, and they've stepped up. Our medical examining board announced that the new guidelines that will go into effect at the beginning of the year that are more aggressive than what the CDC announced earlier this year. Our dental examining board is going to announce guidelines as well, I'm told. If they do that, they'll be the first dental board in the nation to have prescribing guidelines. And we saw between the quarter right before we announced the Dose of Reality campaign or kicked it off and the same quarter this year, we saw a 10% decrease in opioid prescribing. It's been a long time since we've seen a drop.
And I want to compare this to the crack epidemic back in the 80s. Looking back at those days, that was seen, I think, almost 98%. This is a law enforcement problem.
Absolutely.
It seems like the balance here is, yes, there's law enforcement, there's public health, there's compassion, and there's treatment. And I know you're looking for more funding for treatment alternatives in the courts. Is that right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. We went after, and you know, back in the days when we had the crack epidemic, there were drug houses in that traditional sense people think of. Now we don't have that. Now a drug house is a cell phone. It's usually a throwaway phone that the dealer keeps for a week or two, and then they'll meet you in a parking lot somewhere, usually in a car that's either stolen or it has false plates on it. There's no way for us to track them down the way we used to. And this is a public health crisis. We can't focus. We do need to go after those who are trafficking heroin and fentanyl and the pills, but we have to focus on prevention. And we have to focus on getting people who are already struggling in treatment. You're right.
One challenge, there was just an arrest in western Wisconsin, a series of arrests. Meth was involved in that, too. This is multi-jurisdictional. As you say, it's not this house in our community. It can cross city right. lines, county lines, state lines really quickly. Is that an extra challenge?
Absolutely. And that's what the Vernon County Sheriff reflected in that large-scale bust was they found themselves very quickly in La Crosse and then in the Twin Cities. These things are moving all along the freeways, and it is a challenge for us. The bottom line is, as long as the demand exists, someone will take care of the supply. We can, every time we take down a drug dealer, there's somebody coming in to take their place. We need to keep working to have every Wisconsinite recognize the dangers of starting to experiment with abusing prescription painkillers.
Well, shifting gears now to the John Doe investigation, there have been investigations that had been going on a long time, aftermath still being felt. There was a big leak of material that wasn't supposed to be leaked in that. You are looking at opening up a grand jury, I think, investigation into that.
Yes, that's what we're looking at as probably the only option we have. This isn't going to be a traditional investigation where you knock on doors, go to see people at their business. These are all government officials we need to interview. We know where they are. It's easier to set up interviews in that courtroom setting than to go track them down at their workplace. We can't use a John Doe to do this. That wouldn't fit the statute. We tried to have a special master appointed by the Supreme Court, and they disagreed, and I get why, because they'd like to extricate themselves from the investigation, and that makes good sense. The judicial branch typically doesn't do investigations. So it made sense that they declined that. So really a grand jury is our option that's left.
What would be the timeline on that?
Things are actually moving pretty quickly right now.
So we could see something early in 2017?
Yes.
What are you hoping comes out of this? You're hoping to obviously find out who leaked these documents.
Right. That's what we're looking to see, whether we can determine where the leaks were.
And you've called in the past for changes to the John Doe laws in Wisconsin. Are you still hoping for that? What would you like to see?
Well, the changes that occurred, I can live with. Mm-hmm. There was some talk about getting rid of that as a tool for prosecutors altogether. I wanted to avoid that. It is a valuable tool for prosecutors working on a missing persons case, a homicide case, a drug conspiracy case. There are effective ways to use that, and I didn't want to see prosecutors lose that tool altogether.
And it's been taken off the table mostly for political issues.
Right.
Do we have the tools in the state to avoid corruption and other improprieties, quid pro quo, right, donations, things like that?
We do have the ability to use the grand jury. It's more cumbersome because you have to assemble citizens and make those arrangements, whereas the John Doe is simply in front of a judge. It's more cumbersome, but we have that tool. We've never lost that.
Talking to Wisconsin State Attorney General Brad Schimmel, covering some big issues out of 2016 going into 2017. A lot of media reporting around the country and cities and here in Wisconsin on untested rape kits, backlog supposedly. Now, you took some issue with how this was characterized in a USA Today Wisconsin investigation.
Yes, because frankly, what's happening in Wisconsin is we're leading the nation. Out of the two granting authorities, the proposal we made got the largest grants in the nation from both of the granting authorities because we've proposed a statewide solution. There's very few places that are doing that. Most of the time they're approaching it as a city or a county issue. We're taking on the whole state, which takes more work, but it's the right thing to do. And we're also doing this from a victim-centered approach. You cannot take away the power of a victim to control their destiny. You can't now say because they submitted to this test and they've never consented to having that test, this kit being tested, we can't just take away that power from them. So we are going back to the crime victims who were subjected to these intrusive tests to make sure they approve of doing this. The other thing we're not doing is testing kits we don't need to test. In many of the states, they're doing what is called the forklift approach. They're just coming in, they're taking all of the kits and they're submitting them for testing. That's clogging up the labs that are capable of doing this work with backlogs, because if we've already convicted someone, we'll get their DNA sample. We've already got that on the system. There's no need to go back and test that sexual assault kit anymore.
Is there a hope that by testing more kits, we'll be able to identify serial sexual assault perpetrators and maybe solve some currently unsolved cases?
Yes, that's exactly the hope.
So maybe we want that forklift approach? Maybe we want more of that data?
Well, we've got the data already. Once a person's convicted of certain crimes in Wisconsin, they are then required to submit a DNA sample through the court process. We will have put that on the data bank already. To go back and test the sexual assault kit on an offender we've already convicted and identified doesn't make any sense. You're just duplicating efforts.
My understanding is that maybe there's been that reported rape, a rape kit is sitting there untested. It's not attached to that perpetrator who's given DNA yet. If we test it, we might find that they're culpable in more cases than we knew about previously.
Yes, but as long as we've already got their profile, we'll be comparing that on the data bank and we'll already make that link.
But there's an untested kit there, I'm saying, that maybe perpetrator X it will be identified there in a case that we hadn't attached them to previously. Does that make sense?
I do think I understand your question. The point is, if we've already identified who committed the offense in this sexual assault for which a kit was drawn, if we've convicted them, we already have their DNA. We don't need to go get it from the kit as well. Now, if we've got an unknown offender, those are the kits we're testing.
Okay.
That's what we're doing.
I think I follow that. One more issue I want to get into, Wisconsin's redistricting and some other election laws may be on the road to the Supreme Court?
We expect so.
The U.S. Supreme Court, should specify.
Yes. There's no guarantee, but we expect so. There's never been a political redistricting case, which is what this one is, that's been upheld all the way to the Supreme Court. Racial-based redistrictings have been struck down in the past. This is a novel approach, so we expect the Supreme Court will be interested. And it doesn't just affect Wisconsin. This will affect state houses nationwide.
Right. Past cases, as you mentioned, have said, okay, African-American voters have been unfairly disenfranchised. You got to change that. This case says mathematically Democratic voters' votes are underrepresented, are effectively disenfranchised. And this is a new mathematical model to prove it. So what kind of things are you looking at as you would argue this case?
Well, one of the arguments we make is that you have to take into account and the mathematical theory that the challengers are proposing doesn't take into account that you get districts where it's just areas where it's just natural that people of the same kind of political persuasion will live. In the urban areas like Milwaukee and Madison, they're very, very heavily Democratic. And it's very difficult to not see the vote in that area watered down to some extent when you go to counties like Waukesha and Washington, which are very heavily Republican. You get the same effect there, but the opposite party. So that's our argument. Ultimately, we do expect the Supreme Court will take this. Justice Kennedy, as in the past, looked at cases and said, you know, this is okay. I'm not going to vote to strike this down, but there is the potential that a case could go so far in its political redistricting that I would strike it down. Now, our argument is that there have been other state redistricting maps that have been more partisanly charged than what happened in Wisconsin that have been upheld. So under those circumstances, you should be able to predict what's legal based on what courts have decided before.
Point of curiosity, would you be arguing this in person in front of the U.S. Supreme Court or a designee of your office?
Oh, a designee. We'll have someone from our Solicitor General's office do that. These are much sharper lawyers than I.
You never get to have the fun.
I had 26 years in the courtroom.
Fair enough.
My fun.
Attorney General Schimmel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Republican Brad Schimmel has been Wisconsin's Attorney General since 2015. He joined us for a look back at 2016 and to talk about his priorities in the coming year. On December 25th, 1991, Mikhail Gorbachev announced that he'd be stepping down as the president of the Soviet Union. His resignation came at a time when the Soviet Union's relations with the world were starting to thaw after years of distrust during the Cold War, especially with the United States. The end of the communist government helped pave the way for the formation of independent governments in new independent countries. Keith Darden joins us now to talk about what happened then and what it means today. He's a professor in the School of International Service at American University, where he focuses on nationalism, state building, and the politics of Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. Keith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, a lot of the response, I think, on this side of things here in the United States was, yay, Soviet Union ends, happy times going forward. The view was more mixed within Russia and the rest of the Soviet Union, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. I think most people in the former Soviet Union separated the ending of communist rule and the Communist Party from the breakup of the Soviet Union. And they were pretty happy about the first part. In other words, they didn't like living under communism, but they didn't necessarily want to see their country break up.
Right. So we ended up with all these new countries or restored countries, Russia, Ukraine, Latvia, Uzbekistan, and the rest. Why did it go that way? Why didn't it stay one Soviet Union without the Soviet part?
Well, part of it was that the leaders of those republics wanted to seize power for themselves. So in particular, Boris Yeltsin, who had become president of Russia, of the Russian Federation, while it was still part of the Soviet Union, had a constant tension with Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the leader of the Soviet Union. And one way to resolve that power dispute was to get rid of the Union itself. And so the real way that the Soviet Union ended was by an agreement between Boris Yeltsin, the head of the Russian Federation, and the heads of the Belarusian and Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republics to disband the Union and to replace it with a weak and decentralized Commonwealth of Independent States that would make them sovereign rulers.
And all of a sudden, these people were big fish in their smaller ponds. Not small, these are still pretty big countries, but they got to run their own countries, in effect.
Exactly. And, you know, Boris Yeltsin got the biggest pond, and he was a pretty big fish.
Well, I want to start looking at the echoes of what happened 25 years ago on today. Some people were very upset by this breakup of the Soviet Union and saw it as a diminishment of Russian power, Russian prestige in the world. And one of those people was named Vladimir Putin. Can you talk about his path from 1991 to today?
Yeah. So in 1991, Putin was a KGB officer stationed in East Germany, and he witnessed the collapse of the East Bloc firsthand. And when he came back to St. Petersburg, which is where he was from, he worked for the mayor of St. Petersburg, Anatoly Sobchak, who was a Yeltsin ally. But he, you know, if you read Putin's memoirs, he sees the withdrawal of Russia from the international stage, the breakdown of order domestically, as a real consequence of the collapse of communism and the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so while he often says that anyone who doesn't regret the collapse of the Soviet Union has no heart, but anyone who wants it back has no head, I think there are many ways in which he sees the collapse of the Soviet Union as the source of many of Russia's problems today.
And talk about some of Russia's problems today. What kind of things have happened that people view as a decline?
In the Russian government, in this current Russian government, they're primarily concerned about the presence of NATO in former communist territories, its encroachment on former Soviet territories, in particular Ukraine and the Baltic republics, Georgia. And so they see the geopolitical costs of weakness as being very significant, and they seem to genuinely feel threatened by the West. Some of it is certainly ginned up to shore up popular support at home when the economy is declining, but some of it is a genuine concern about U.S. power and the power of NATO getting closer and closer to their borders. And they see that as the main consequence of the Cold War, that they think that the end of the Cold War was misplayed by the leadership of the Soviet Union, by Mikhail Gorbachev, and by Boris Yeltsin. And they're seeking to replay that endgame and redress those wrongs.
So what would that involve? Is the occupation of the Crimea, parts of the Ukraine, is that part of a bigger picture of building those borders back outward?
Yes. So that's exactly what it involves. It involves a revamping of the Russian military to create expeditionary forces that can be used in the immediate post-Soviet space and also as far away as Syria, revamping the nuclear forces to maintain their nuclear deterrent against the United States. And so we may see more aggressive activity from Russia as it seeks to sort of establish its credibility as a great power in its own neighborhood.
You know, you can make the statement, Western Europe is scared of Russian expansion. The Russians are scared of encirclement by the West. And that statement would be true in the 1800s under a czar, the 1900s under a communist party chief, and now in the 2000s under Putin. Can we learn anything that will resolve these tensions from the last couple of centuries?
I think one thing we could learn is that states will act on the basis of what they perceive to be their vital interests, whether we think that is normatively undesirable. In other words, we don't think it's a good thing that Russia annexed Crimea, but we probably could have anticipated it after the government in Kiev was overthrown, and that we should be just more clear-eyed about what countries' perceived intrinsic natural interests are and try to negotiate around those rather than provoking them. I think there's an extent to which we could have avoided the crisis that we're in now. Russia certainly could have avoided putting us in this crisis. But there are things that we in the West could have done, perhaps to have kept Ukraine whole and Europe a little bit more peaceful.
Well, now Donald Trump is the president. He's spoken favorably of Russia and of Vladimir Putin. Is this maybe an opportunity? A lot of people were worried about this. Is this an opportunity to make a more positive step and resolve these differences in a more positive way?
This is the moment of truth. We'll know what Russia we're dealing with under a Trump administration. If Trump is truly conciliatory towards Russia and recognizes the annexation of Crimea and some of the other things that have been bandied about by his team, then if Russia is truly reacting to the West, they'll back down and we'll see a reduction in their provocations, fewer flyovers of their military aircraft over the Baltic states or Sweden and Norway. If, on the other hand, what's been going on for the past few years is that we have been successfully containing Russia from acting even more aggressively in the East, then it's very likely that a conciliatory Trump is going to be essentially taken advantage of, and Russia is going to be able to make moves in Ukraine and in the Baltic states that they never would have been able to do under a previous U.S. president.
We'll leave it there for now, Keith, but I hope you'll join us as these things develop.
Be happy to. Thanks for having me on the show.
That's Keith Darden. He's a professor in the School of International Service at American University, where he focuses on nationalism, state building, and the politics of Russia and neighboring countries. Joins us to talk about the end of the Soviet Union and what's happened between now and then, taking us up to today there. There's been a long-running link in American culture between issues of race and of mental illness. For long periods of time, minority groups, including African Americans and Jews, were seen as racially prone to certain types of mental illness that based on various kinds of racial pseudoscience. But over the last century, a new idea started to get attention that racism could be seen as a kind of mental illness. And some recent news reports suggest that certain kinds of medication might actually lower people's racial biases, leading some people to think that racism could be a treatable mental health condition. Our next guest says it's way more complicated than that. Sander Gilman joins us now. He's a professor of the liberal arts and sciences as well as psychiatry at Emory University. He's the co-author of the new book, Are Racists Crazy? How Prejudice, Racism, and Anti-Semitism Became Markers of Insanity. Sander, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start back with that first idea I mentioned, that there's this history of linking minority groups with particular types of mental illness. You even reference a condition supposedly that made slaves want to escape. This was seen as a mental illness, in effect. This has a long history, doesn't it?
It is a very long history, and the notion really was that groups that were sort of seen as less civilized, outside the norms of moral action, were seen as predisposed either because of biology or because of culture to various forms of mental illness. You mentioned drapetomania.
That was it, yeah.
Dr. Samuel Cartwright's notion that if slaves run away, it's a symptom because, of course, benign white slavery was the proper place for a slave, and if the slave didn't see that, it was clear that they were mentally ill. These notions were applied to virtually every group you can mention, to Jews, they were applied to the Irish, to Native Americans, and it became a kind of a commonplace. People saw groups on the margin as predisposed to mental illness and therefore in need of control.
Things changed, and in large part around World War II and after the horrors of World War II, this idea began to take root that to commit horrible acts of racism, to be an extreme racist, must be some form of mental illness. Where did that idea first come about?
Well, it sort of comes about, actually, right around the time of the First World War. Assuming, by the way, that serious thinkers, and this is across the board, really did believe that minorities were predisposed to mental illness, The counter notion arises among groups that are marginalized. For example, Jewish physicians in Central Europe start to say, hey, wait a minute, we're not crazy. It's, in point of fact, the society which demonizes us and the people in that society are crazy. And something happens which is, for me, very interesting. Because, you know, racism is a very interesting phenomenon. It is extrapolating from specific qualities, perhaps of an individual, the qualities of some kind of collective, right? The Jews, the slaves, the blacks, the Mexicans. When we know these are very complicated groups, and the idea really was that this collective, which was called race, began to have a kind of parallel, starting really in the 1890s, 1900, and that was called the mob or the crowd. And you could move the mob or the crowd to act irrationally in ways such as racism by having things like a charismatic leader. And so what happens around the First World War, and this is why it's so fascinating to me, is that British psychoanalysts and psychiatrists start to write books trying to explain the Germans. Right? The Germans. Why are the Germans so evil and so bad? And the answer is because they're crazy. They've got a crazy leader, and they themselves are crazy. This is the First World War, right? Mm-hmm. This is the way of understanding the Bush, right? The Hun. And this collective, right, the mob, right, the crowd, comes to be absolutely parallel to the notion of the race. And so by the time the Nazis come around in the late 1920s, early 1930s, there's kind of a natural way to critique Nazism and fascism as a form of collective mental illness caused by what? The charismatic leader, Mussolini, Hitler, Franco.
We're talking to Sander Gelman about links or not between mental illness and racism. He's the co-author of the new book, Are Racists Crazy? Well, let's get into that question now. This is a very complicated issue because how we define race differs, how we define racism differs, and the meaning of mental illness changes depending on who you talk to and definitely over time. So start to pin down some of those ideas for us.
Well, again, you know, that's why it's so interesting. You have one set of terms, let's say race, which is in point of fact without any real boundaries. In the sense, it's kind of made up as you go along. There is, of course, a science of race, and that science of race becomes important in medicine, for example, in the 19th century. But it doesn't exist in the world. It's projection onto a specific group. You know, for example, I'll give you just one example that I've always loved, which is the notion that there are sort of physical characteristics as well as psychological characteristics that determine the membership in a group. African Americans have black skin. Well, one of the products of slavery is the fact that at the end of the 19th century, an awful lot of African Americans began to pass as white. And Mark Twain wrote one of his most stellar novels about two infants, one black and one white, but really with the same color skin, who are exchanged in the nursery, and one is raised as a shiftless black man and has all the bad black characteristics, and the other is a noble white man, except the black man is white and the white man is black. So this notion of race is, in point of fact, in a sense, constantly evoked and constantly made up. And so one of the things that's really important is this is also one of the problems with this ever-changing catalog of mental illness. So at the end of the 19th century, Jews are seen as highly predisposed to hysteria. Right? They wander across nations in the Paris clinics in the 1890s. There's a young man who writes a whole dissertation about the mentally ill Jews, and he says these are the wandering Jews. And they're all hysterical, right? They're all hysterical. So you're quite right. Race is a very, very unstable category, and so is mental illness. It doesn't mean, by the way, that mental illness doesn't exist, and it doesn't mean that genetic cohorts don't exist. But what gets superimposed on these two categories are oftentimes fantasies about collectives.
Let's talk about modern-day racism now and if we can attribute it to mental illness. And I referenced briefly, and you start your book talking about this, you know, people taking a medication, this is a few years back, that seemed to lower their inherent racial biases. So there we go. We can give somebody a pill. It'll bring down their demonstrated racism. Just not that simple, is it?
Even better, we can put it in the water like fluorine. We can get rid of racism in the whole world. We just have to give beta blockers to everybody. The difficulty with that study, it's 2012, is that what is defined as racism and what is, quote-unquote, alleviated and measured by these psychological tests is kind of inchoate. Right, it's kind of inchoate. And so a few years later, a group of people who were interested in reducing people's fears about spiders give them beta blockers. And it turns out if you keep them on beta blockers, they're no longer afraid of spiders. Is this better than behavioral therapy? No, because if you take them off of the medication, they become anxious again. So maybe the medication reduces some kind of anxiety that is triggered by the imaginary or something like that. But this is this kind of mechanical approaches to racism that we've seen recently. There is a very serious neuroanatomist who's very interested in his claim that with the right kind of brain scan, he can tell in advance of a person becoming a racist, whether they're going to become a racist or not. And then maybe we just give them beta blockers, and we don't even have to worry about racists because we'll get them in advance of them becoming racist.
You're skeptical of this way of thinking, if I'm reading your book right, that you don't see racism as just something that comes from a natural predisposition in our brain. There's a collective element to it, a historical element to it.
And a social element. Mm-hmm. That is, of course it comes from things in the brain. I mean, that goes without saying, right? I mean, our brains are who we are, and we are our brains. But that doesn't mean that our brains are kind of parallel processors, some kind of computer that's gone awry, because everyone lives in a world, and that world creates certain images and fears and notions of proper and improper actions, which is what we start to talk about really, by the way, at the same time around the First World War with people like W.E.B. Du Bois, as racism coming out of society, right? And you can't give people a pill for society. You've got to think about society as something which we hope, though the recent past gives us pause to think, can at least create laws and structures which make it difficult for people to impose their notions on other people. My rule of thumb is that people's freedom stops at the end of my nose. And so racism strikes me as something which may exist, can be ameliorated over time. We've seen that, by the way, with the changing social status of gays and lesbians in the United States, even though now, of course, transgender people have come under the microscope. But the real question really is that racism, when it's medicalized, lets people off the hook. Rather than saying you've made an evil choice, you're doing a bad, an evil thing, we say to them, and we've seen this with many, many celebrities, right? They get drunk, they become unpleasant to the cop who's pulled them over, they revile him with anti-Semitic statements. when he is called on it, when the person is called on it, he says, what? I'm going into therapy, and then, therefore, I'm going to be cured.
We're talking about the relationship between racism and mental illness. Our guest is Sander Gilman, co-author of Are Racists Crazy? How Prejudice, Racism, and Anti-Semitism Became Markers of Insanity. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. What relationship do you see, if any, between racism and mental illness? Or is thinking about racism as a disease, something we can cure, a bad idea? Is it oversimplifying just to look at one person, their attitudes kind of isolated from how they were brought up, the society they live in, the history they grew up with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We pick up our conversation now with Sander Gilman, co-author of the new book, Are Racists Crazy? How Prejudice, Racism, and Anti-Semitism Became Markers of Insanity. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. What relationship do you see, if any, between racism and mental illness? Or is thinking about racism as a disease, as something maybe treatable, maybe with a pill, a bad idea? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Allison is on the line in Madison. Allison, hi.
Hi. What I wanted to ask about is the work of a scholar that I heard speak and read her book, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. And it, I wondered if the if your speaker's familiar with that work. And to me, what it tied into what you just said about racism as a mental illness sort of being a way of, perhaps being a way of getting off the hook for the reality. This turns that on its head, and it talks about the like post-traumatic stress disorders as a generational reality stemming from, I mean, from, among other things, the way that mothers would try to protect their children from the abuses of slavery through the generations.
Allison, thanks for the call. Any thoughts, Sander?
Well, there are a number of very good empirical studies recently, obviously, looking at the children and even the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors, which make the point that oftentimes within these families there are, there's an 800-pound gorilla in the room that is not acknowledged, right? The notion is that these families tend to function in such a way as either not to speak about the past, this notion of protecting, or indeed to see the present as very separate from the past. And this is, you know, one wishes one were able to take a look at the generation immediately after slavery, or even that generation subsequent to that. What happens is that we know is that this dissipates over time. But this is absolutely something that is, you know, demonstrable, which is that traumatic acts have impact. That's a very different rationale than saying, for example, that these traumatic acts then provide a kind of rationale for evil actions. That is not part of this literature. In fact, one of the things that talks about that is talked about over and over again is how these, especially second generation, tend to be kind of frozen psychologically in time and space. It's almost a form of chronic depression. So the answer is absolutely. We know this, by the way, in the survivors from the Yugoslav massacres. We know that in the survivors of genocides, that the second and third generations are oftentimes impacted.
Allison, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Richie in Minnetonka, Minnesota. Richie, hi.
Hi. My question to you, doctor, is aren't we all mentally ill to some degree?
Well, you know, again, we're back to defining things, right? The answer is, you know, Freud has a lovely definition. He says, you have psychological difficulties when you have difficulty with the two core parts of your life. And he says those are work and love. So the answer is many of us have to cope in complicated ways with the world around us. There are ways which distort our daily lives. There are ways that make us less capable of dealing with our daily lives. And so I would, you know, globally, I would say no, because we make a kind of a distinction between being able to cope and not being able to cope. And it strikes me that that's a good sort of measure when we start to talk about racism and mental illness. So, for example, I would argue that racism is not a form of mental illness. It's not a form of mental illness for the Nazis. It's not a form of mental illness for the so-called alt-right, which is basically neo-Nazis. But it is also the case that people who are severely mentally ill can focus in on, obsessively focus in on, qualities that we would think of as racist. It's a difference between a classification which says racists are all mentally ill, and we can say that some mentally ill focus in on their neighbor who is Muslim and focus in also on the fact that the CIA is trying to read their thoughts. So I would be careful about saying we are all mentally ill, you know, maybe except you and me.
Briefly, as we start to wrap up, Sander, is part of the problem in having these kind of conversations that it seems like racism is a yes or no, either or binary thing? Either you're a full, as commonly defined, you are a member of a white nationalist organization, or you don't have a racist bone in your body, and there's not, people don't recognize a continuum there?
There's a complete continuum. And one of the things that making people responsible for their statements and actions, including members, by the way, of outgroups of minorities, right? I mean, I had a student years ago who, as a satire, right, is really a satire, said that gay people could not be prejudiced. And she said, of course gay people can be prejudiced. They can be prejudiced against, but they also can be prejudiced. So one wants to really be careful about thinking of these collectives, just as we really will avoid one of talking about race as a reality. Talking about racists as a kind of easily defined collective is something we also want to avoid.
We'll leave it there for now. Sander, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Sander Gilman. He's professor of the liberal arts and sciences and psychiatry at Emory University. He's the co-author of the book, Are Racists Crazy? How Prejudice, Racism, and Anti-Semitism Became Markers of Insanity. Still time to share your thoughts on that and other topics over on the Central Time Facebook page. Just head over. You can find links to information about this and some of the other conversations we have there. By the way, take a minute to go to WPR.org if you're looking for new ways to listen to Central Time and all your other favorite shows, maybe outside of the car or the home radio. Check out WPR.org and download the WPR app. Make that an early New Year's resolution. You'll be able to listen on your smartphone. There's Android and Apple versions. And you can listen on your phone or tablet while you are cooking, exercising, or whatever you want to do. Again, that's the WPR app. You can download it over at WPR.org. We hear a lot about people organizing themselves into political bubbles, just interacting with people who have similar views, following news sources that confirm their beliefs, that kind of thing. Well, it turns out the same thing might be true about the TV shows we watch, not the news shows, the things we watch for entertainment. A data analysis in the New York Times looks at Facebook likes for different TV shows, maps them out, and finds some big divides in who watches what and where. Urban areas in the U.S. have more than average likes for shows including Modern Family, The Big Bang Theory, The Simpsons, The Tonight Show, and So You Think You Can Dance. Rural areas go for NCIS, Supernatural, Duck Dynasty, Cake Boss, and Grey's Anatomy, among many others. Those are just a few of the trends. We have a link to the whole thing with maps of 50 different shows over at the Central Time Facebook page. By the way, you can scroll down to the bottom, enter your zip code to see what's relatively hot in your area. This, by the way, could be a fodder for a future program on Central Time. Maybe the answer to reaching across rural-urban divides, the partisan boundaries, it's an old-fashioned TV party. This is Central Time.
We're going to have a TV party tonight.